you cannot judge a career on record sales. You
right.
cannot. You judge a career on the amount of people and the quality of people that you've influenced. That's how you judge a career. I mean, if you look strictly at record sales, you know, that is such a shallow, crappy corporate way of looking at it.
Achieved the ultimate dream, being a big fan of a band and then ending up being in that band. Can you talk about how you originally got into the Ramones?
I actually just went, I went to an open audition. I had heard Dee Dee left, and a friend of mine was playing with Joey's brother, and he called me up and he was like, "Hey, the Ramones are auditioning bass players today, you should go down, blah, blah." But, at the time, I was actually in the Marine Corps, and it was so that made the whole thing kind of pointless. But I figured I'd go down and just, you know, I'd just get to meet the guys and all that good stuff. But, you know, of course, as fate would have it, I got asked to come back several times to the, you know, to audition more songs. And, and that's pretty much how it happened. I just kept going back. You know, they kept asking me back, you know, learn a couple more songs. And that's what I did. I just kept learning songs and going back. And eventually, at one point, I realized, hey, you know, there's a good chance I'm going to get this.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to take care of business with the Ramones. With the Marines. And, sure enough, I got the audition.
So I heard somewhere that you were in military jail when you got the call from Johnny to join
the
band.
Yeah,
is that right?
That's correct. That wasn't it wasn't a very graceful entrance, but it worked out. It worked out good. Mm-hmm. I at some point during the auditions I realized I had to go back and because I had been gone for quite a while, I got, I had to spend a little time at the Hotel Grey Bar. But it was, Johnny called me up on my first night there and said, "Hey, what's up?" And I said, "Yeah, sorry, you know, I should have let you guys know and whatnot." And he said to me, "Well, you know, what are they saying?" I said, "They're saying, you know, I'm going to have to be there a couple weeks and then I'll be out." And he said, "All right, well, do your time, don't get in any trouble. When you get out, you got a job."
Nice. So growing, you're obviously from New York. Were you a big fan of theirs growing up, and do you remember seeing them play live before you were in the band?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, I was a huge fan. Everybody out this way was pretty much. But I'd seen them a whole bunch of times between 80 and 87. I'd seen them a whole lot of times. Saw them with Richie, saw them with Mark. Only one I didn't see was Sammy. But it was just one of those things. You're from New York, you were a Ramones fan, and realistically, everybody was. But, I never dreamed that I'd be in the band, of course. Yeah, it was. I think every musician always has that dream, of playing with a band that they love and that they grew up with. I mean, when I was a kid, I remember hearing the story about the guy at the Who concert. Keith Moon passes out on stage, and I think it happened here in New York too. I don't know. And they said, "Does anybody know the songs?" And this guy got to jump up on stage and do the Who songs,
mm-hmm.
play the concert with them. So, I think that's every musician's dream. But I never really thought it would happen, mm-hmm. especially not the way it did at the time it did. But something else. Even to this day, I still have to laugh about it. It was bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
It was just completely bizarre. It's not something that you ever expect to happen.
Right. There's a lot of stories about the tension between members in the band. Can you kind of talk about the dynamic between Johnny, Joey, Marky, and you, and how you fit in as the new young guy? How that all worked?
I figured out pretty quickly through a stupid mistake. About the whole thing about Johnny and Joey. I mean, I picked up on it immediately from the get-go, but I, in a normal conversation, I made a little slip up, and Monty came to me and said, "Hey, listen, I said to, I got into the van one night and I said to Johnny, "Hey, how's Linda doing?" And all of a sudden everybody got real quiet, and Joey chuckled a little bit, and Monty pulled me to the side later on. It was like, "You have no idea, huh?" I was like, "No." He's like, "All right, here's a deal." And he told me the story between Johnny and Joey and Johnny's wife and all that stuff. So I just kind of I learned to keep my mouth shut. But that was I realized from the beginning, even before I knew that, I realized there was there was animosity between them. And I saw pretty quickly that it was going to be kind of a tightrope walk. If I got too friendly with Joey, Johnny would get mad. If I got too friendly with Johnny, Joey would get mad. I had different things in common with the both of them. Me and Joey were more friends. Johnny was more like my teacher or my mentor or, father figure, whatever you want to call it. So I really paid more attention to Johnny on a daily basis, just because I was trying to learn as much as I could while I was out there. But, at the end of the day, me and Joey would go out and see shows together, or I'd go stay at Joey's house, his apartment, and we'd work on songs or whatever, or just listen to music and talk. And, I got introduced to, Joey's little circle of friends and whatnot. So, it was really a balancing act. And I tried not to be a politician about it. I always said what I felt to both of them, rather than try to, agree with both of them and inside I really didn't. But, when the things I felt Johnny was right about, I stood up for Johnny. The things I felt Joey was right about, I stood up for Joey. I mean, there were some things I stood up for Joey on that really bothered Johnny, like as far as Joey's health and us working and all that stuff. I try to get Johnny to understand, "Hey, listen, if you give this guy time to take it easy, it's going to lengthen our career. We'll be able to stay, tour more in the long run." And Johnny's view always was, "We take time off," and the guy goes out and does a million other projects, doesn't rest. We go back out and he's still dead tired. He's like, "So we don't do that. We don't You know, when we get offers, we go out and do it. We can't be, you know, taking time off so he can go do, you know, projects with other people. And Johnny was right. In the end, I found out he was right. That, you know, when I looked back and I thought about it, he was 100% right. Every time we were off, Joey was involved in something else with somebody else and planning parties and doing shows and recording with other people and stuff. So, yeah. You know, Johnny was like, if he's going to work, he might as well be working with us.
Right.
You know, so. But yeah, it was a tightrope walk. It definitely was, and I learned early on if I was gonna, you know, survive in the band and, you know, get established, I was gonna have to find a way to do that without, you know, pissing everybody off. And you know, that's the way I did it. I just made sure that I was honest and I. You know, said what I felt, not what they necessarily wanted to hear.
Right. So how did you guys know it was kind of time to wrap it up when you decided to call it quits in 1996?
Joey was sick for a long time. Joey got diagnosed long before anybody heard about it and knew about it, and he struggled nightly. You know, he really did. I was singing more and more songs in the set. He was singing less and less. He was really struggling just to get through the tours and stuff. Johnny came to me and he said, you know, 1995, he said, hey, this is our last year and, you know, we're going to do our retirement tour at the end of this year and that's going to be it. And I was totally cool with that. I understood. I agreed with him. I said, you know, I think that's good. And I had planned a cross-country motorcycle trip for the summer of 96. Back in 92, I told Johnny that I'd be taking that summer off. So I told him, well, now you don't have to worry about taking the summer off. But, you know, we made the decision. We were doing our last tour in the States, playing the same clubs we had for years and years. And that's when we got the call to do Lollapalooza.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when Johnny first proposed it, I told him, you know, you guys can do it without me. I said, I'm not doing it. I told you I was taking that summer off. I said, we tried to get on that tour for how long, and they turned us down, and now because we're retiring and there's a story attached to it, they want us. I said, you don't know what them assholes want, John. I was like, don't even bother. Don't even give them the satisfaction of entertaining it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, no, we're going to do it. I said, well, I'll tell you what. You know, I think what you should do is get Dee Dee back in the band and talk to Tommy and see if Tommy will come out. If not, to play every night, you know, to come out on the tour and at least jump up there with you guys. I said, get up there and do with the original lineup. I said, it'd be an unbelievably poetic ending to your career. The press will love it. The fans will love it. I'll meet you in some of the cities and I'll run out on stage and I'll do Strength to Endure with you or something here and there or, you know, whatever you guys want me to do. I said, but I think that would be, as a Ramones fan, that's what I would want to see. And he said, well, that's because you're an old fan. He said, you know, there's most of our fans now are young fans and they never even seen Dee Dee. A lot of them don't even know Dee Dee was ever in the band. He said, they want to see you. You're good on stage. You get up there and you're good. He said, you know, take your time and think about it and let me know what you want to do. So I took a little time and thought about it. And, you know, I came to the conclusion that, you know, for us to just peter out playing the same little clubs that we have for years and, you know, and kind of go out with a puff rather than a bang really wasn't fair to the band. I felt like, you know, at least they would get, you know, the exposure and, you know, and play in front of big crowds and stuff, and hopefully get a chance to see how much of a mark they really made. Because on that tour was going to be Soundgarden, Metallica, Rancid, you know, all these big bands that I knew, not personally knew, but I knew from reading about them and everything else, were all influenced by the Ramones, and all Lister Ramones is one of their favorite bands.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and I said to John, all right, I'll tell you what, I'll do the tour, but I do it on my motorcycle. I ain't riding with the band. No sound checks. I get there when I get there, and you know, and that's it. And that's the only way I'll do it. And John was like, all right, sure, but if you miss a show, you lose a week's pay, which at the time was $700, so I didn't really care one way or the other. I was like, wow, big deal. So that was it. That's what we did for our retirement tour, and just, you know, like I said, every day the guys from Soundgarden and Rancid came by their dressing room, and Johnny and Joey sat out there and held court and talked to them. And I think, I think that's the tour where they really fully understood. Like, Johnny had always talked about it, and Joey had always talked about it, you know, how unique they were in their history and blah, blah, blah. But I think until they heard it from the biggest bands of that era, mm-hmm. of the 90s, when all of those bands, including, you know, Kirk Hammett from Metallica, started to come around and sit around and talk with themselves, Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam, you know, him and Johnny got to be real close. When all those guys started coming around, I think it really sunk in, and I think it gave them a much better perspective on their career, because, you know, they always felt burned that they didn't have the commercial success. You know, early on they were a pop band. Mm-hmm. They thought they were going to be like the Bay City Rollers or, you know, one of the boy bands. They thought they'd be huge.
Yeah.
You know, they knew they had some of the greatest rock and roll ever recorded. You know, they knew it. And it just burned them so bad that they just got totally ignored, and nobody ever figured out a way to market them or to get them to the masses. And they really felt burned by that. They really did. It really bothered them that they did not have a gold record except for, you know, Mania. And but I think on that tour they got some satisfaction out of, you know. I try to explain to John, I said, you cannot judge your career on record sales. You right. cannot. You judge your career on the amount of people and the quality of people that you've influenced. That's how you judge your career. I mean, if you look strictly at record sales, you know, that is such a shallow, crappy corporate way of looking at it. I said, you know, you have to look at it for you know, for really for what it was. And that's, you know, I told him, I said, you know, Dee Dee was probably one of the greatest rock and roll songwriters of all time. And even to this day, he's not recognized as that.
Right.
He's still not recognized as that. You know what I mean? He's, you know, it's Crazy Dee Dee. Well, you know what I mean? And that's how, you know, that's how they all felt. They all just kind of felt shunned. They all felt like, you know, they had been on the outside all that time, and they deserve to be on top. And if you listen, if you go back and listen to the, you know, what they put out, man, those first four records, it's you would be hard pressed to find another band with four consecutive records where there isn't a single filler song on the record, not one, on all of their four records, from Ramones to Leave Home, mm-hmm. to Rocket to Russia, to Road to Ruin. You listen to those records, there is not a single filler song on any one of those records. And I'm a big music fan. I can't think of too many other bands that by their third record wasn't really trying to find, you know, the magic they had in the beginning.
What do you think about End of the Century?
End of the Century, to me, is the end of their, you know, their greatness. That's when they kind of slipped into mediocrity. As soon as, yeah, you know, it's not common knowledge. I don't think a lot of people know it, but, you know, Tommy Ramone is the man. Tommy's, that was funny. Tommy's the guy that came up with the look, the sound. He invented punk rock drumming. Nobody played that style before. Mm-hmm. Tommy invented it. And now you listen to any modern punk rock band, and all the drummers play that style or some variation on it. You know, he was the sound. He was the look. He created the image. He told everybody what instruments they were going to play. Tommy was the guy. As soon as Tommy is out of the picture, the Ramones descend very quickly into mediocrity. Mm-hmm. I mean, that record with Phil Spector, a couple of good songs on it. The rest of it is filler. The production on it makes them sound like a half-assed pop band. And that's the beginning of a whole line of them being, you know, made to work with producers who, one, didn't understand the band, and two, just try to turn them into whatever was popular at that time period. So you get you know, they were some good songs on those records.
Yeah.
On all of those records. I mean, there's four or five good songs on every record, but the deeper you get into their career, approaching Brain Jane, the fewer and fewer good songs you hear.
Right.
But the one record in that pile of crap, the one jewel in that, is really Too Tough to Die. And that's because Ed Stasium and Tommy Ramone come back into the picture. And suddenly they sound like the Ramones again. They're fired up. Dee Dee's writing angry songs. And it's the old Ramones are back. And to me, that was their comeback record. That really was their comeback record. But the follow-ups just never, you know, they just couldn't stay on that track. And it's not because I'm on the record or anything like that. You know, the next really great record after Too Tough to Die is Mondo Bizarro, and that's because Ed Stasium is back in the producer's chair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ed Stasium is really the guy that understood what the Ramones were about and knew how to bring out the best in their sound. And you know, I mean, you could argue that if Ed and Tommy produced them the whole time, they would have, you know, 15 albums that all sound exactly the same. Yeah. But you know what? So what?
Right.
So what? It's better than 15 albums that sound like a band that can't find their direction.
What do you think? Go ahead.
That's my opinion. You know what I mean? I would rather have heard that production on, and it wouldn't have been just that production. You know what I mean? It's not like Ed Stasium, you know, started, you know, never changed a thing from the day he started producing. You know what I mean? He's gotten his skill set's gotten better and better over the years. And Tommy, you know, I think at some point probably would have backed out anyway. Tommy really got into his own career there doing bluegrass. But you know, that's my opinion. I think over the years, had they stayed with Ed, they probably, sonically, the records would have been very similar, but they would have been a hell of a lot better than what we ended up with in the end.
So what is Mondo Bizarro your favorite out of the ones that you played on?
Yeah, it's really the only one that I like all the way through.
Yeah,
Local Live is probably the worst record they ever put out sonically. It's just terrible, unbelievably bad. The guy that produced it just wasn't even a fan of the band. Didn't even know anything about the Ramones. Overdubbed the drums. He overdubbed the cymbals and the hi hats and the snare and the kick drum. I overdubbed everything. I mean, there's nothing live on the record, which is pretty typical for live records. I hate to burst anybody's bubble, but most live records you hear are live drums only. But just the mix on it is terrible. The overall production is beyond lame, and the drum overdubs are just ridiculous and totally apparent. Acid Eaters should have been an EP. There's a whole bunch of songs on there that could have been left off. They would. You know, just not very good.
There's a few that gems on there, though.
Right, yeah. There's six really good songs on there. Six good, strong songs on there. Everything else could have went in the toilet, you know. Well, no, I could have taken them or leaving them. And Adios Amigos was just not a strong record. Not a very strong batch of songs there.
Yeah.
Not for a farewell record, anyway. I mean, I wish I would have had the Bad Chopper record or Reconquista, my own records. I wish I had some of those songs written, because most of the stuff on those two records is way better than what I actually ended up on the record. I hate to say that because, you know, there are a couple of nice ones on there, but, I mean, that was just a lot of filler.
I had another question.
It sounds so bad.
No, that's all right.
I'm like ripping apart the remotes for history here, but that, you know, I can't be anything other than honest. And, you know, realistically, I'm talking as a fan.
Right.
Not even as a band member. I'm talking as a fan because I am such a huge fan and I have been a huge fan for so long that as much as I love those records and everything for the fact that it's them and they're gone and that's all really we have left of them, it's disappointing that their catalog could have been had so many more brighter spots if they had, you know, just taken the reins and done it their own way.
Right. Another thing about the Ramones I wanted to ask you about was, it seems like you guys were always bigger in other parts of the world than you were here, like particularly down in South America. Why do you think that was?
The because in the United States, we have an overabundance of stuff. Our attention span is so incredibly short, and trends come and go so quickly. Things are passe, you know, weeks after being really popular and big, you know what I mean? And in the States, everything gets marketed to kids. So kids get, I mean, they get pulled all over the place, you know what I mean? And, you know, what happened is, right there in the 80s, you know, all of a sudden, ghetto culture became big mm-hmm. in the States. And all the kids started going to that type of music. You know what I mean? Started listening to rap and hip-hop and stuff. And that's, you know, that's really where youth culture went to. It wasn't punk rock anymore. It wasn't even rock and roll anymore. I mean, the realistically, the one band that came in and kind of saved the day was Nirvana. Mm-hmm. Nirvana was kind of the band that came in and just shook it all up and you know, got the kids back onto rock and roll anyway. And punk rock, and then of course you had to follow it up by the, you know, by the whole by the punk, you know, all the new wave of punk bands, but you know, there is no, we really lack loyalty to things here. You know, it's, people tend to jump on the new trends. I mean, that's just how it is here, and in other countries, it's really not like that. Rock and roll, you know, when we go to Europe or we go to South America, we get treated like legitimate artists. We get treated like, you know, like we, you know, what we're doing is legitimate. But even to this day, when you tour in the States and you go to a town and you go to a club, you get treated like a shitbird who's too lazy to get a job.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Our whole we don't look at rock and roll as an art form here. We don't have respect for our own culture. We don't have respect for our own culture, for the things that make you know, make America different and great. We don't have any respect for it. And rock and roll is one of those things. Punk rock and rock and roll is one of those things. People just, you know, it's like oh that. You know what I mean? Oh, wasn't that popular back in the 70s? Like, that's the mentality here, you know? But in, you know, a place like South America, we went down there and it was, we were like the Beatles. Mm-hmm. I had a security guard with me 24 hours a day. They used to sit outside my room on a chair while I slept. I mean, that's how big we were there. And, you know, friends of mine have said to me, you know, they're just so far behind the times. You know, when you were there, they had a dictatorship up to a couple of years before you went there, blah, 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 and this and that. I said, I understand what you're saying, but even now, I played at a Walk Now for Autism Speaks benefit, a fundraiser, actually, on Sunday. My son is autistic, so I play it every year. Mm-hmm. I got up with some friends of mine, and we did a bunch of Ramon songs. And every kid in that place was dancing. And that's because that's what the Ramones music brings out in people. You know what I mean? When you take kids who are not, there's nothing in their thought process that keeps them from liking something for any other reason than they don't like it, and you play it for them, they just react immediately. And that's really how it is. You know, it's like when you go to other countries, people hear it and they just immediately pick up on what it's about. They get what the energy is about. Here, people are bored with that. They're like, oh, yeah, I've heard that before. Yeah, nothing new. Yeah. But you go to other places and, you know, and even if they are not totally excited and blown away by the music anymore, they still respect you for the historical context of the band and the band's history and the band's sound. You know what I mean? So you still get respected, but it's just not like that here.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about your new album. You have a new album coming out on Fat Records in November. Can you talk about that and talk about your who's in your band? Because that's quite a lineup.
Yeah, so March of this year, I jumped into the studio with Steve Soto and Dan Root from the Adolescents, and we had Dave Hidalgo Jr. on drums. I had been writing songs since Ray Conquista was recorded. I really never stopped writing, but I had a batch of songs together, and I demoed them and sent them out to those guys, and we agreed we'd record in March, and we jumped into the studio in March. Went to the studio, had no idea about the title for the record or the artwork and nothing like that, and we got down to the recording. You know, Steve and Dan both played on Ray Conquista. Steve co-produced Ray Conquista.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I worked with Steve a bit in 22 Jacks, did a little touring with him and stuff, and we always got along great. Huge respect for Steve's entire career and, you know, everything he's done, and, you know, a whole slew of great bands. But, I mean, the guy's just such a great singer and great performer. It's really, you know, we really are like a great team together. We really work well together. And Dan Root's just an unbelievable guitar player and singer. You know, he had before he was in the Adolescents, he had a one hit wonder there, and you know, guy's got a great voice. He's a great guitar player, and he's such a solid guy. You know, the cool thing is that we're all vets. We've all been to the top and back and sideways and every other way. We've been in the business for a long time, and it's so great to go out on the road with guys who I know are going to get on stage. I don't have to carry the whole show. You know, the harmonies are all great, and they're solid players. So going into the studio with them, I go in really confident. But and that's how it happened. We just went into the studio. Everybody learned the songs. We rehearsed them for one day. I think Dave laid down his drum tracks in a total of 6 hours, 7 hours. He had his drum tracks done. Total time recording, I think, was 2 weeks maybe.
Mm-hmm.
To get everything down. And it's sitting there in the studio, you know, that's when we kind of decided that Last Chance to Dance would be a great title for the record. It's something I say at the end of our set every night. I would, you know, the last song, I would say, all right, this is Last Chance to Dance. It's kind of how the title worked into the lyrics, I had an idea for artwork for the record that I wanted a shot from New York City in the mid 70s, and I came across a great photo taken by Alan Tannenbaum, who's a real real famous photographer, lives in New York, of a prostitute standing in Times Square.
Yeah, it's an awesome picture.
Say again?
I said, yeah, that's an awesome picture to use for the cover.
Yeah, thanks. And it's real funny. I called up the guy who was going to take care of the artwork for me, and I said, I'm going to send you this picture, check it out. You know, I'd like to hunt this guy down, see if we could get the rights to it, and send the picture to my bud. And he goes, I know Alan pretty well. I'm pretty good friends with him. And it's so funny because it all came together like that, and then I found out that he had taken that picture in August of 74.
Hmm.
And the record was slated to come out in August of 2014, 40 years from the date that he actually took the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, I think August 74, the Ramones had played their first show. Was it August 74? Anyway, sometime in 74, the Ramones had played. And there were all these little things that all tied in together that told me that, you know, this was... this was going to work. That it was meant to be this way, and you know, of course, that I was planning on putting the record out myself, and then Mosrite Records had stepped up and asked if I'd like to put it out with them, and then of course, you know, Fat Records heard about it and got in touch and came out and saw us play Punk Rock Bowling, and the rest is history.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to the album. Are you guys gonna Are you guys going to tour, or how is that going to work?
Absolutely. You know, up to I've really been little by little every year touring more and more. Of course, now it's a little bit tougher with three kids and a wife that works real hard at home. But you know, we've been kind of working towards this and setting ourselves up for the last couple of years, and we've really worked hard to get everything in place. And I'm really hoping that this year I can go back to recording. To touring full time. I really would like to get back out there and really start hitting the road. I mean, things have changed a lot since I toured with the Ramones. It's not like, you know, you can just jump in the van with your gear and go. You know, gas prices are real expensive. Everything's a lot more expensive, and you can't just get out there and do it like that anymore unless you're making a whole lot of money. But you know, what I found is that you know, there's all kinds of new creative ways to do it, and we've got Stormy Shepherd at Leave Home Bookings booking us in the States, and Stormy and I have worked together before when I was in Los Gusanos, and you know, we've been trying to come up with some creative ways of me being able to get out there and see everybody and get to everybody. You know, I get requests constantly on my Facebook page. Hey, when you coming to Virginia? Hey, when you coming to Texas? Hey, when you coming to Oklahoma? Mm-hmm. You know, you know, I tell everybody 2015, I'm going to try to get everywhere I possibly can. So, you know, I'm hoping that this year is the year that I make a full comeback and I can get back to doing what I love full time. Three.
Three angels on my shoulder.